Well, thank you for your attention already. My lab focuses on targeting prostate cancer stem cells, and I'm going to first give you an introduction of what cancer stem cells are and how they're defined before I get into my research, just to give you guys some background. And so what is a cancer stem cell? So the definition of a normal stem cell is that they can self-renew and they have potency. So depending on what kind of stem cell you're talking about, the potency levels change. So in embryonic stem cells, they're multipotent and polypotent. So you've heard about the induced polypotent embryonic stem cell studies. And so that means that the cells can differentiate into any kind of cell at the body. When we're talking about cancer stem cells, obviously a cancer stem cell probably won't be able to give rise to every single type of cell in the body, but they are defined as being able to give, all the different types of cells, lineages of the cells in the tumor. So all cells in a tumor are not equal. Some have much more abilities to proliferate and to give rise to different types of cells, and other cells are very, what we call differentiated, and they do not have the stem cell properties. So thus, this indicates that there's a hierarchy in the tumor-initiating capabilities of tumor cells. So we've known for a long time, if you take a tumor out of a patient, not all those cells will be able to give rise to a new tumor. And these studies were primarily done when tumors were implanted into mouse hosts, and we know that maybe one out of a million of those cells are actually able to develop into a mouse or into a tumor in the mouse. And those are how all of our xenograft models were derived. And also, when we derive cell lines, not all cells out of a tumor are able to give rise to a cell line when you culture them in vitro. So first thing I wanted, this cancer stem cell hypothesis has been kind of popular in the last decade or so, but this really isn't new. Back in the 1950s and 70s, a pathologist, Dr. Barry Pierce, actually did observe that tumors kind of had an organogenesis type pattern, where if he looked at a specific type of tumor, say prostate, that there were several different types of prostate-like cells within the tumor. So not all cells were equal. And so then he kind of proposed that there was this organ, so just like an organ can develop during development, a tumor can develop in a similar fashion. And then it was really in the 1990s that Dr. John Dick, actually at the University of Toronto, provided the first evidence of existence of cancer stem cells in leukemia. And this is still probably the most well-defined type of cancer stem cell there, because in the liquid leukemia tumors, they have very strong models that can actually prove that the cancer stem cell, that the leukemia can come from a single cell, whereas in solid tumors, we don't really have the luxury of these kind of models. And of course, as in any popular cancer treatment, the media gives out many different types of articles saying that we found the new cure for cancer. You know, we've probably found 5 or 6 different cures for cancer in the last 3 or 4 decades. So it's going to be a combination of all these things. We're learning more and more. So obviously, I don't think this is a cure for cancer, but it's something we definitely need to understand about the tumor and cancer so we can treat it more effectively. So just in the schematic of the cancer stem cell, so the stem cell can actually self-renew and then give rise to the different types of cells in the tumor. So why is this important? Well, it's thought that cancer stem cells have a lot of survival properties, and conventional cancer treatment, while we can target a lot of these proliferating cells and tumor cells, the cancer stem cells have a lot of resistance mechanisms, and they are hypothesized to survive treatment. And it's these cells that are hypothesized to cause the tumor relapse or cancer recurrence, which is actually the thing about cancer that we really need to target. We can actually target the primary tumors fairly well. We can regress tumor size and have look like there's good outcomes, but it's these remaining cells that are resistant to the treatment that we need to focus on. So with one of the mechanisms of trying to identify cancer stem cells, we have a problem in that the cancer stem cells are generally fairly rare, and we have to be able to isolate them from the rest of the tumor to analyze them. So generally, we will dissociate a solid tumor, try to isolate a cancer stem cell based upon markers that we think are cancer stem cell markers, and then we need to show that the cancer stem cell can regenerate the tumor, whereas the majority of these cells will not be able to generate a tumor. So we do this generally with antibodies or some sort of fluorescence-type marker, where I'm sure you guys are all familiar with antibodies and attaching different fluorochromes. And so if the red antibody was a stem cell, you know, these might be the very rare cells depicted in this tumor immunofluorescence. With cancer stem cells, we actually have to isolate those. So we use flow cytometry and FACS analysis quite frequently. Let me go back. Where we take our cell suspension, we identify our potential cancer stem cells with, you know, a red and a green marker. And if they have, you know, both of the different fluorochromes, we can actually identify our cells with the specific markers. And with FACS sorting, this is just flow-activated cell sorting, the cells will go through a flow cytometer, and depending on what settings you set, you'll assign a charge to the cells. So if the yellow cells will be assigned a single negative charge, and the red cells will be a double negative charge. And these can be deflected with these deflector plates and put into specific sorting tubes. So at the end of the procedure, you can actually walk away with a tube of potential stem cells. So what makes leukemia in some of the blood tumors a very strong model for cancer stem cells is that we're actually able to isolate the hematopoietic stem cell in the leukemia stem cells and graft them back into irradiated mice. So mice, like humans, you can give it lethal dose of irradiation, kill off all the natural bone marrow, and then replace it with your cells of interest. And this is actually really particularly strong because you can actually put human cells into the irradiated mice because you've killed their immune system. Whereas in solid tumors, that's not really a possibility. So over the years, they've actually been able to figure out the exact markers for the hematopoietic stem cells. And I'll never ask you what is the specific markers of a hematopoietic stem cell. I just want you to know the concepts. Like, you know, I might give you markers and say, oh, test if this has stem cell capabilities type questions. So don't go memorizing all these things. But in the hematopoietic system, they've actually have a set defined set of markers that if they isolate cells that have this profile, a single cell, they could put it back into an irradiated mouse and it will develop a complete hematopoietic system. So that is the true test of a stem cell. And then in the 90s, what the group in Toronto did was actually use those markers in human leukemia patients and engrafted mice with leukemia stem, what they thought were leukemia stem cells. And so first they actually did colony formation assays, and they were colony formation assays, and they were able to show that the hematopoietic cells with the hematopoietic stem cell markers actually had more colony formation capability and that they could engraft into mice and retain the stage of leukemia that the original patient had. So if they isolated leukemia cancer stem cells from a stage M2 patient, the mice would present with an M2 type stage of leukemia. And then they were actually able to go and go further and actually use the exact markers, the CD. So all the CD34 positive cells had an enrichment of engraftment of leukemia into the mice. And then the CD34 positive, CD38 negative cells also had even more potential. So I mentioned before that cancer stem cells have lots of resistant mechanisms. And here's just a few of them. So we're going to talk mostly about the multi-drug resistant pumps because that's what my research focuses on today. But they also have a very high aldehyde dehydrogenase activity to protect them from damaging alcohols. They have radiation protection where they'll actually upregulate their checkpoint kinases to mediate DNA repair instead of forcing the cell to go into apoptosis. They have elevated telomerase activity. So in all these things combined really make this a very resistant population, which makes sense because for evolution, you want your stem cells to be highly protected because you don't want to lose those. But in cancer, it can be not a great thing. So we first became interested in ABC transporters because of work that Peggy Goodell did, where she showed that in the hematopoietic system, she was actually looking for cells that had high DNA proliferation and high, so HERX is a dye that will bind DNA, and if the cell is proliferating, it has a double amount of DNA. So she was thinking that stem cells might have a high DNA content compared to normal non-stem cells. So she was staining the hemopoiet, the bone marrow, for DNA content. And she found, while she was looking for cells that had a high level, she found this one population of cells that were off to the side of the cytofluorograph, and she called these the side population because they were dye negative. So the cells had DNA, but they were actually able to exclude the dye. And when she added the verapamil, which is a calcium blocker inhibitor, this population was removed. And she implanted these cells, the side population cells, into mice, and they were very few cells were able to generate the complete hematopoietic rescue, indicating they had stem cell properties. A couple years later, the ABC transporters were really being cloned and identified. And it was shown that a subset of these transporters could actually efflux the HERX dye. So verapamil in the previous study was blocking the ATP production or the ATP-dependent pump activity of these pumps. And so that's what the ABC stands for, the ATP binding cassette transporters. And these were originally discovered because they're upregulated when you treat cells with drugs that these pumps can efflux. So mitoxantrone is a classic drug that a subclass of these transporters pump. And if the resistant cells, if you treat your cells with mitoxantrone, cells that can upregulate this pump will become resistant and will be the selected cells in that culture. So obviously these are very important with drug-resistant mechanisms, and then they were also discovered to be highly upregulated in the stem cells. They're very evolutionary conserved. They're in bacteria, and they are present in both the plasma membrane of the cells and in organelles. And they, again, use ATP there's an active transport. And so far, there's up to 50 different ABC transporters. And these are some of the subfamilies. So they're very creative in their terminology. They're ABC A through G. And each of these subclasses have several members. And they can efflux everything from cholesterol, which is the primary is what all steroids are made from, many types of drug resistance, iron transport, bile salt transport, and what we're interested in is we're not interested in them because they can actually efflux the Herx dye because nothing's evolving to efflux a dye, but it's actually a very easy way to isolate these cells with FACS sorting. And then what we've actually been studying is that in addition to effluxing cholesterol, a couple of the pumps, G2 and B1, can actually efflux steroids. So in prostate cancer, having something that can regulate your intracellular steroid levels is very important. So this is just another methodology about identifying or isolating cancer stem cells. And what's really important is you need to, in addition to isolating your stem cells, you have to be able to exclude your non-cancer cells. So there's lots of different cells in a cancer that aren't cancers. You have endothelial cells, you have immune cells, you have stroma, which are all very important in the signaling and microenvironment of the tumor, but they themselves, when transplanted, are not cancer cells. And then also, when you digest tissue, has anyone here done a single cell digestion of tumor tissue or any kind of tissue? Well, usually you use these this enzymatic mixture of collagenase, dispase, to break up that cell-to-cell connection, but that actually was really hard on your cells, and a lot of your cells will die, and then you'll just have a whole bunch of debris in your mixture. So you really have to be able to get rid of that. So you have to have viable cells with whatever interest, in this case the ABCG2 pump, for your analysis. And then again, so you can isolate your cells, you get rid of your tumor cells that aren't tumor initiating or stem cells, they don't form tumors, and then your potential cancer stem cells will provide tumors. And this is actually a really excellent review. It's a little old, but it's how the industry standard is. So Dr. Chadha was here last week, and we all know prostate cancer is bad. It's the second leading cause of related death in America. It's actually one of the most highly diagnosed cancers. And what's the problem with prostate cancer in the treatment is the treatment for advanced disease really hasn't changed in several decades. And we have, we are very blessed that we have the PSA exam or test, and we can diagnose prostate cancer very early. But for those patients that don't have an early diagnosis and are not eligible for surgery, we really have very limited options. And the problem with some of these treatments, our convention or standard of care is using androgen deprivation therapy for advanced prostate cancer. And this is from the 70s. We haven't really progressed that much in the last 40-some years. And with androgen deprivation therapy, we know that the majority of the tumor cells do need androgen for survival. So when we undergo androgen deprivation therapy, we get rid of most of the tumor cells. But what my research interest is that we hypothesize that these stem cells are actually they don't need androgen to survive, and when you take it away, they don't really care. So they survive the androgen deprivation therapy and give rise to the castration resistant prostate cancer. So we've already kind of gone over some of this a little bit. So in the prostate, the normal human prostate is surrounding the urethra under the bladder, and it has a hierarchical set of cells. We have prostate stem cells giving rise to prostate basal cells and luminal cells, whereas in prostate cancer, we hypothesize the same sort of hierarchy is going on with the cancer stem cells, the tumor cell giving rise to the prostate cancer. So we have many markers for these different cell lineages in the prostate. So we have The basal cell markers, P63, cytokeratins 5 and 14, and the basal cells in a gland surround the luminal cells, which are the tall columnar cells in the prostate that have androgen receptor expression and different cytokeratins. Of course, we have all these non-epithelial type cells. We have our endothelial cells, fibroblasts, urethrite cells. We have the prostate stroma. And then we've been focusing on trying to identify the prostate stem cell. In our original work was looking at the, we did a screen looking for any stem cell marker in any organ. And ABCG2 was really the leader of that screen, whereas we could find ABCG2 expressing cells outside of this basal luminal cell layer where we hypothesized stem cells would be. And then we also were able to show that the androgen receptor, which was stained in red, that these cells were negative for the androgen receptor. And we didn't really know if they would be positive or negative at this point or not, but in future studies, this does make sense. And then again, so this is the P63 basal layer of a prostate gland, the luminal cells, and then a potential stem cell. And this was right around the time when it was being shown that the ABC transporters could efflux steroids and estrogen. So we did an experiment where we used radio-labeled DHT, which is dihydrotestosterone. And when we had the DHT in added to ABCG2 expressing cells, they had very little retention of DHT. And then when we inhibited the ABCG2 with novobiacin, which is an ABC transporter inhibitor, we could increase intracellular levels of radioactive DHT, which implied that inhibition of the pump allowed DHT to go into the cell and not be effluxed out. But this was a pretty indirect measure of that. And then we also showed that cells with DHT and the ABCG2 inhibitor had a very elevated level of the androgen receptor. So most steroid receptors, when they have their ligand, they're stabilized and then able to translocate into the nucleus. This was a short time point, so there wasn't active transcription and translation. It was most probably a stabilization of the androgen receptor protein. So this led to our hypothesis that we're working on now is that, so steroids can either be actively pumped into cells or they can diffuse through the membrane because they're a steroid. And that in cells that have the ABCG transporter, the DHT is never able to bind to the androgen receptor and it's effluxed out. So these cells have very little DHT and the androgen receptor is not very active. And then when we inhibit the ABC transporters, the DHT or the androgens can stay intracellularly, bind the androgen receptor, and then AR can translocate to the nucleus. And then from that, we hypothesize that androgen receptor activation can lead to cell differentiation, and that's leading up to the hypothesis. And why this is important is because, so we have, here's our little schematic about the prostate, and we have a stem cell niche that's giving rise to transit amplifying cells and the different cells of the prostate. So in normal prostate, we have secretory cells, basal cells, and neuroendocrine cells. And in cancer, we have tumor cells and the cancer stem cell. So the secretory cells, basal cells, and the cancer cells all rely on DHT for survival at this point. And when we take DHT away, we've shown that we do get apoptosis of the majority of the luminal cells and the adenocarcinoma cells. And then eventually we'll get rid of the cells that are the progenitors to those cells. And eventually, the cancer stem cells, in the absence of DHT, are going to turn back on whatever pathway they turn on and are going to give rise to recurrent prostate cancer that really doesn't need androgens to signal. So with the model we're proposing is that if we block the ABC transporters, the DHT can actually get into the stem cell compartment, and that we hypothesize that this will actually eliminate this whole stem cell compartment through differentiation. That's probably a lot of slides on your notes, sorry about that. And then since those cells are eliminated, when we eliminate DHT as subsequent therapy, the cells that do need DHT to survive, again, will respond, and we will have a slower castration recurrent prostate cancer development. So the overall hypothesis in the lab is that ABCG2 efflux of androgen inhibits prostate stem cell differentiation, and this actually maintains stem cell properties. And we've developed our experiments in three aims, determined we want to know what the mechanism of androgen efflux is to maintain the stem cell properties. Actually, I think I changed this a little bit in the lecture, but and then we want to identify what the side population, how that is actually maintaining stem cell properties. And then we want to know what happens when we abrogate ABCG2 function. Can we actually use this as a potential therapy? So work done by my graduate student, Neha, is that she wanted to know exactly what AR is doing when we inhibit the pump in the presence of DHT. So she uses a couple different cell lines. We see the same results no matter what prostate cell line we're using. And that in our controls, we have very little expression of the androgen, nuclear androgen receptor. And then when we add DHT to our ABCG2 positive cells, we again see very little AR expression. And these are ABCG2 negative cells with DHT added. So generally when you add DHT to prostate cells, they upregulate the androgen receptor. And I forgot to mention, but these are in cells that she used a magnetic bead isolation to isolate out the ABCG2 positive cells from the cell line. And then when she adds DHT and the inhibitor, she can see an upregulation of AR in the nucleus. And so does that actually lead to cell differentiation? So she looked at different cell differentiation markers, the cytokeratins and PSA. And again, when we have DHT and the ABCG2 inhibitor, we see an upregulation of these differentiation markers. And then the important part of the experiment, she actually put in enzalutamide, which is an AR inhibitor. And we can, if we block AR signaling, we lose this AR, this cell differentiation. And she's also gone on to do RT-PCR studies for AR regulated genes and also saw those were elevated. So this leads to, so we know that when we inhibit ABCG2, we increase our nuclear androgen receptor expression and activation, and that leads to differentiation of the cells. We need to still determine, I need to change that slide. So we did determine that if we block AR, we do not get the differentiation of the cells. So you can just cross that part off. So then to look at see what stem cell properties that the ABCG2 expressing cells have, this is 8 years worth of work, so it's narrowed down into 10 minutes of presentation, which is a little disheartening, but that's the way things go. So we actually got human specimens that were classified as non-tumor and tumor from patients digested them and then put them through the side population assay. And this just shows the flow cytogram of this analysis. And when we have the side population represented about 1% of the cells in the prostate specimens. And then we also had, we used a mouse model, a TRAMP model. We could also find the side population in human prostate. And then we just did real-time PCR and showed that ABCG2 is elevated in these cells, which is to be expected because they are isolated based upon high pump function. So in leukemia, in the hematopoietic system, we have the bone marrow transplant assay. In prostate, we have tissue recombination assay. So in collaboration with Dr. Foster, we had, you can take out embryonic rodent urogenital tracts and dissect out the urogenital sinus, which is right here. And you can see this is 1 millimeter, which is about the size of this urogenital sinus. And this will develop into the prostate upon development and pre-birth. So these are about day 18 embryonic rats. We can dissect out this urogenital sinus, and what we do with this urogenital sinus is we can actually dissociate the epithelium from the mesenchymal sections, and you can actually just teaser it apart, and you're left with the urogenital epithelium and the urogenital mesenchyme. The urogenital mesenchyme will signal any type of epithelial cell into becoming prostate if it has stem cell potential. So if you use the urogenital mesenchyme and you put your stem cells of interest and then you do a kidney graft, which we'll show on the next slide, if it has stem cell potential, it'll develop into prostate tissue. And they've actually done these studies with bladder stem cells, urethra, prostate, vagina. And I think they've even gone further lately with embryonic stem cells, breast stem cells. They can all recombine and develop into prostate. And that's because this mesenchyme has such a strong signaling potential that that's what's needed. So we took our side population cells from human specimens and then isolated them and then basically put them on the urogenital mesenchyme, and we developed this in just collagen and then engrafted them under the kidney capsule. So here's a kidney with something that didn't grow, that's just a collagen pellet. And then here's a graftment that did grow into prostate tissue after about 8 weeks of growth. And these are very classic assays from the 70s, and Jerry Cunha really pioneered this type of technology. And then, so if you take histology from these prostate tissues, you can see that they develop into nice prostatic glands. They're very organized with luminal cells and stroma. And then, so we did a single cell dilution, and we were actually able to put as few as 50 cells that we sorted into this assay, and we got full prostate development. Of course, in theory, you should be able to do this with a single cell, but technically, we couldn't do those experiments. This is just some more of these types of graphs. So we have, so the ultimate stem cell assay is, so we have this one graft that was shown in the previous slide. We dissected it and took a little piece of this and put it with new UGM. And then we pushed it further and we could develop a new prostate. So it's still containing stem cells that still express the different basal cell markers, luminal AR markers. There's still some ABCG2 expressing cells, and we couldn't really get PSA expression, but we think that was just the timing of the assay. So this is all really great for benign stem cells. So this is a benign stem cell assay. And actually, when people have put cancer cell lines in this assay, it actually normalizes them and makes them grow into normal, differentiated prostate tissue. So that's very interesting, but it doesn't tell us much about the cancer stem cells. So right now, we're currently trying to see if what kind of assays we can do to test for cancer, prostate cancer stem cells. Some groups have shown that cancer-associated fibroblasts mixed with initiated cells will develop into prostate tumors in this assay, whereas if you use benign-associated fibroblasts, they do not. So that's one possibility. So we did show that the side population does enrich for prostate stem cells, but again, we need to determine what the cancer stem cells are doing. So that leads to the last aim, in that we look at the what's the role of ABCG2 in the stem cell maintenance. And so stem cells really aren't that proliferative. They have lots of potential to be proliferative, and they should have infinite potential to be proliferative, but just in general, they don't proliferate a lot unless they have to. And so one of my undergrad students for the summer, Karina's work, was actually just looking at seeing if inhibiting the ABCG2 pump in cell lines with DHT would actually inhibit proliferative growth. So she did show this in several cell lines, whereas DHT alone and inhibitor alone didn't really affect cell growth. And then we also started using sphere formation assay. So this is an in vitro assay where you plate cells in Matrigel, and if they have stem cell properties, they can develop into a sphere in the 3D culture, whereas a lot of tumor cells cannot do this. This is kind of like a 3D colony formation assay that is kind of used for tumorigenicity studies. They're very similar. There's very minor differences between the two assays. So we were actually starting to work in the mouse prostate because trying to get human specimens all the time was getting a little tiresome. And with mouse genetics, that provided a powerful tool. And my student, Mugda, who graduated last year, actually looked at the sphere formation assay from mouse prostate stem cells. And she showed that compared to the vehicle control, when she added the ABC inhibitor, she actually got a significant reduction in the sphere formation assay. So inhibiting the ABCG2 transporter actually reduced stem cell potential. And then we also showed that with several different cell lines. Here's just this one prostate cell line. Again, when you add the ABCG2 inhibitor, you get a decrease in sphere formation, indicating loss of stem cell properties. But what we really wanted to do is in the mouse has this potential. So it's been known that in rodents, if you do a castration experiment, the prostate will, all the luminal cells will apoptose and the prostate will regress. And then you could add testosterone back, the prostate will regrow. And you can do this for infinite cycles, indicating that the stem cells are actually able to respond to this androgen deprivation environment. And they do so in a very organized manner to where this is a prostate gland and you have stem cells at the proximal part that's going to insert into the urethra, which is this U. And when androgens are present, they proliferate and differentiate the cells into this nice glandular organ. And then so this is in the presence of testosterone. And then when you remove testosterone, these all regress, and your number of luminal cells decreases. So we wanted to do this experiment with a genetically null ABCG2 mouse, and we were able to acquire the knockout mouse from Brian Sarasano's lab, at St. Jude's, where ABCG2 is embryonically deleted. And this is just a very classic knockout of ABCG2, getting rid of exons 3 and 4. This isn't a conditional knockout or anything fancy. And surprisingly, these mice are fine. You would think that if this is a really important transporter that they would have some defects. But since there's 50 of these transporters going around, we assume that they're being compensated for by other transporters. So our first experiment with these mice was just to see if we could, if their stem cells had any different properties. And we saw that actually they were, cells from the prostates were actually had very high sphere-forming efficiency, which was a little surprising if ABCG2 is really required for stem cell properties. But this that made sense after a few more experiments. And actually, these mice have a hyper stem cell compartment at the beginning, but it doesn't last. It's a very sensitized stem cell population that doesn't have infinite proliferation, infinite potential. And then when you inhibit the pump, you get a decrease in the sphere formation. And we showed just with this one experiment, so we performed castration on the mice, and then we added back testosterone and the ABCG2 inhibitor. And we showed at the first generation that they had a very, they had actually a very high level of stem cell proliferation and sphere formation capabilities. And then we're still carrying on these experiments, but after a few cycles, this is really, the prostates aren't able to regenerate. So in summary, we've shown that ABCG2 is a marker for prostate stem cells. Cancer stem cells, we're still, we've only got cell line data for that so far. And that when we inhibit ABCG2, we can force stem cell differentiation in the mouse model and in cancer cell lines. We're still looking for that perfect cancer model that's not just cell line based. And this is evidenced by AR nuclear translocation, elevation of differentiation markers, decreased cell growth, and decreased sphere formation. So again, we want to get this back into clinical significance. Oh, I went really fast. We could take questions at the end. But so what we want to do is we want to see if we can target the cancer stem cells so we can reduce the tumor relapse. And again, so the cancer stem cell treatment is what we're trying to do before we have the tumor cell treatment. And again, we said that with androgen deprivation therapy, we can get rid of the majority of the luminal tumor cell type cells. But it's those cells that remain are the ones that lead to castration resistance. So we propose that if we can actually pre-treat patients with an ABC inhibitor, we can force these stem cells, stem-like cells, to differentiate. And then, so it's important that when we do this inhibition, that the DHT is present in the system, because once we remove DHT, these cells won't care if they're differentiated, or they won't care if the pump is inhibited here or not. So you have to do a pretreatment and then add the androgen deprivation therapy, and hopefully that will prolong relapse into castration-resistant prostate cancer. And these are the people who did most of the work, and those folks that are underlined actually contributed data to this talk. And I'll take any questions.